This is very important. Black lives have always mattered. We have always been important. We have always meant something. We have always succeeded, regardless. And now is the time. I ain't waiting. Look, I don't know if I'm going to have a career after this. Fuck that blood.
That's the actor John Boyega in London at a recent protest against racial injustice and the death of George Floyd. This is The Letterbox Show, and this week we're celebrating black life and black voices on film. This is The Letterboxd Show. I'm Gemma Gracewood, Letterboxd's Editor-in-Chief. This episode is dedicated to films about the black experience. And joining me now from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Letterboxd member Adam Davey. Hi, Adam.
Hi, Gemma. How are you?
I'm good. I'm fine. I can't complain. How are you? How's Pittsburgh?
I'm doing well. It's heating up just a bit. And as you know, we're on the East Coast here. And so we receive about 6 months of warm weather out of the year. So I will not complain, because before you know it, winter will be here. And all the things that I love, such as, being outside to exercise, to play golf and do a few other things, it's all going away. So I am happy that somebody's here.
No complaints about the heat, but also, when you said it's heating up, I was like, oh yeah, it's heating up, man. Oh, yes. Oh that kind of heating up. Oh, summer yes. Heating up, because mm-hmm. It's also already hot out on the streets in other ways, right?
Exactly. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I think we're going to get into that in a bit, because that's exactly why I mentioned it.
Yeah, yes. So, well, let's get into it. I mean, let's not wait. So basically, if a pandemic wasn't already enough, we have had the heartbreaking deaths of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor in the past few months at the hands of police. Only two names among many more in America and worldwide. And this has given rise to massive ongoing protests in America and around the world against the racist systems that enable racial injustice. Many of the voices in the fight over the past week are also shining lights of the film industry. John Boyega, can we get a whoop for John Boyega? Mm-hmm. Ava DuVernay, Spike Lee, Jordan Peele, the list goes on. And it's so important to see people with platforms use those profiles to help the rest of us feel less scared about getting in there ourselves. And also, it turns out many of us are turning to movies to help to try and make sense of what's going on, to help fill in the gaps in our education, perhaps, as to why it is, for example, a fact that America's black community has been disproportionately affected by the coronavirus pandemic. It's all related. So across Letterboxd, we've seen lists popping up: No Justice, No Peace, Black Power, Educate Yourself, Black Lives Matter, anti-racist films to watch right now. But the most popular list, and that's why we've got you here, Adam, is yours, a list called Black Life on Film. And this is an epic piece of research that's actually been a labor of love for you for the past 3 years. It's not something that popped up in the past week. So tell us how it came about.
Well, it started shortly after I joined the website in 2017. I, like most members, probably the first thing that I did was I scrolled through pretty much all the films that I'd seen up until then, and I was rating them and even throwing in a few reviews for the ones that I really liked. But another great feature of the website are the list. And it's one of my favorite parts of the website, because you're able to get an insight into what other users are watching. You're also able to receive recommendations, and it really can help expand your palette because you will be introduced to a host of films and filmmakers that you probably would never hear of if you're just going to, an IMDb, or if you're just going to some of the journalistic websites like Entertainment Weekly or Variety or any of those other sites. As I was scrolling through all of the list and, liking and commenting, I noticed that there was a huge gap, and it was related to stories of Black America, Black people in the Black diaspora. There are a few lists that were there, And they were probably created well before I joined the site. But there were only a couple dozen films on each list, and a lot of them were the same. So you'd normally see Do the Right Thing. You'd normally see, as much as it pains me to say the name of the film, Driving Miss Daisy.
Well, it's a servant offer that shuffles a little bit and sing.
Yo, man, what?
You'd see films like if, for instance, if you were thinking about...
You're going to say Green Book. Don't say Green Book.
You know, I'm not going to say Green Book, but there I did see a list that was just created maybe within the last week or so. And the user did add Green Book to the list. And another Letterboxd commenter, who is a Black woman, asked her to remove that film from the list. And I am very happy that she did, because that... You know, that film, for a variety of reasons, which, you know, we're not going to get into today, should not be on a list that is celebrating Black life in America. And but regardless, I didn't see anything that encompassed our experiences as a whole, because when you start to dive into the history of Black people in general, most people are going to start with films that focus on our oppression.
And they are this week. I mean, I can give you the data. There has been a 1,000% increase in the number of logged views and reviews written about films like Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, Ava mm-hmm. DuVernay's 13th, and wow. the James Baldwin biopic, I Am Not Your Negro.
Any white man in the world says, give me liberty or give me death, the entire white world applauds. When a black man says exactly the same thing, word for word, he is judged a criminal and treated like one, and everything possible is done to make an example of this bad nigger so there won't be any more like him.
Like it's great. It's definitely telling that people are taking this moment to watch these films and expand our worldviews. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think what I'm really interested in about your film list is that there is often this sort of reach for the stories of oppression and how it is we got here, without the, you know, along the other side, a general empathy opening of looking into how people other than you live, if you are other.
That makes sense to me. One of the things that I was thinking of as I was building the list was the types of films that I really like, because over the past decade or so, I've gone from mainly watching Hollywood flicks to watching more independent films to the art house, and sometimes I even dabble in some experimental features, although, you know, it's not really my cup of tea. But every time I would watch a film like this, for instance, like a Breathless, let's just use that because everybody knows, of the Godard film, I would wonder, like, is there a version of this film with Black people in it? And it turns out that in a way there is, because if you've ever seen Melvin Van Peebles, The Story of a 3-Day Pass.
I have never. That is going on my watch list. Was this The Story of a 3-Day Pass?
3-Day Pass. It's Melvin Van Peebles. It was produced in 1968. And it's about a GI who's stationed in France, I believe. And he's given basically 3 days of rest and recovery, or whatever the military term is. And because it's 1968, but he's in France, he's given a little bit more freedom to experiment. And part of that experiment is a relationship he forms with a white French woman. And the film itself is very carefree. A lot of the jump cutting and different new wave techniques that you see in the films of the new wave directors, you also see in this film. And what I love about it is that racism is absolutely a part of this film. And I wrote in my review, it was just a paragraph or so, but I wrote that racism travels well, because it was there with him in America and it followed him when he went to this foreign country. But what I loved about it was that it was a story that wasn't entirely defined by his oppression, by him being oppressed by a system that, you know, he knows all too well. He was given that moment of freedom. And so as I was building the list, I wanted to find, you know, just as for every film about us being, you know, held back by whatever forces, however you want to define it, I wanted to find a story that was uplifting in a way, or a story that was fantastical, because sometimes, you know, you want to see a story about us that involves something as silly and as simple as us, you know, flying through the sky. And you know, like you see in a lot of superhero films, because, you know, seeing that that image is very powerful. And, you know, we don't have too many of those, but, you know, every now and then you get something that's serviceable, like a Hancock.
Excuse me, please. If you don't move, your head is going up his ass. Y'all fellas sure you want to ride this train?
Shoot you, asshole.
And, you know, now we have, you know, Black Panther.
All right, where am I?
Don't scare me like that, colonizer.
What? My name is Everett.
Yes, I know.
There's a few others, but I didn't want to teach, you know, people with, you know, with the list. I wanted to entertain them, because I wanted to show them that, I guess, Black people and Black stories can be just as entertaining as the majority that come out of Hollywood.
So, I mean, let's talk about the way the list is arranged, because this is what is really useful about it. It's not a single list, actually. It's a master list. And then you've gone and created breakout lists according to the genres that we list on Letterboxd. So romance, action, crime. But the master list, the front page of the master list is, well, it's an absolute masterclass in films about Black oppression and the Black experience and, you know, and the justice and politics system. So you've got To Sleep With Anger.
I have to know who is in my house.
You invited me.
Yes, I did. But only if you are a good man. A friend. Are you a friend, Harry?
The Hate U Give, Hidden Figures, Creed, King, Raisin in the Sun, the Black Power mixtape, Pariah, Black Klansman, When We Were Kings, Malcolm X, In the Heat of the Night, the amazing Tongues Untied, which is so perfect for Pride Month that everyone just needs to put at the top of their watch lists, I Am Not Your Negro, Nothing But a Man, 12 Years a Slave, LA 92, If Beale Street Could Talk, Get Out, Moonlight, Do the Right Thing, and of course, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, Paris is Burning, and the great Hoop Dreams.
And nobody cares about you. You're Black, you're a young male, all you're supposed to do is deal drugs and mug women. The only reason why you're here, you can make their team win. If their team wins, these schools get a lot of money.
And the equally great, more recent Minding the Gap. So there's a real, you know, you can sort of see that there's a real blend of entertainment and drama documentary on that front page alone. Is that deliberate? Like that front page, is that a statement about what you get inside the list, or is it more of a statement about the way you see the world?
That's where the films happen to land when I was putting the list together, because I have it set to list them at their average rating. And I did that because I wanted to instantly capture, you know, the audience's attention, you know, when they see the list. And, you know, if they see it, exactly. So if you had a list that in the first film was Tongues Untied, it may not capture the audience's attention, the viewer's attention, in the same way that Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse will. And, you know, because that was the highest rated film on the list for quite some time. And now it looks like When They See Us is now the highest rated film. So it was deliberate, simply because I wanted to make sure that I capture someone's attention. And like I said, just Into the Spider-Verse is going to, you know, grab your attention far more than a lot of the other films.
Incidentally, Into the Spider-Verse, where did that sit for you when it came out? What kind of experience was that for you?
I had to think about how I would have reacted when I was younger, because, and, you know, and I have to, you know, admit that, you know, Spider-Man and it's just Marvel Comics weren't my thing. I was, you know, a Ghostbusters and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles fan.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? And, you know, obviously I wasn't thinking about, you know, race at the time. They were just fun toys to play with and fun cartoons to watch. But seeing Miles Morales in that film and seeing a young man be as conflicted as Peter Parker was, you know, in his life growing up and trying to deal with these the responsibilities that came with these superpowers while juggling his home life and just dealing with being a regular human being.
I love you, Miles.
Yeah, I know, Dad. See you Friday.
You gotta say I love you back.
Dad, are you serious?
I wanna hear it.
You wanna hear
me say it? I love you, Dad.
You're driving me out of school.
I love you, Dad.
Look at this place.
Dad, I love you.
Dad, I love you.
That's a copy.
That I think that's powerful. And like I said, I can't fully encapsulate how I would feel because films like that weren't around. They weren't as plentiful when I was younger. But I think that the younger me would have really appreciated just seeing a black face. And it probably would have meant a lot more to me as I got older, because I would have understood, like I said, if that film had been around at the time, how important representation was as a whole.
Spike Lee is all over the list, of course. And what I love about every Spike Lee film is the unique filmmaking language he uses that makes each of his films unmistakably a Spike Lee joint. The music, the message, the kooky array of characters, all of whose flaws are on display. The classic technical moves, the walking travelator, the heavy-handed montage of real-life news footage that some people seem to take issue with, as if Spike's not allowed to do this in his own films. So should we talk about Spike? When was the first time you saw Do the Right Thing?
Ooh, that's a good question. It was a little over a decade ago. And I would say in terms of my politics and my thoughts on race, along with a host of other things, I wasn't, as a person, I wasn't involved enough to be able to appreciate what was taking place. You know, I would say that I enjoyed, obviously, the inclusion of Public Enemy into the film. I love, you know, the song Fight the Power. So, you know, maybe around the first time I watched it, you know, something like that really caught my attention. But I just watched it maybe less than an hour and a half ago. And my thoughts now are totally, totally different. And it's such a complex film because the people that you should be rooting for are more than flawed. And we don't have to worry about spoilers here because, I mean, you're pretty sure. So, but
if you have not seen Do the Right Thing, then
exactly.
Pause this, run away and watch it, come back and listen. But honestly, you know, the way the button has been pressed on Letterboxd over the past week, I feel like the whole community has seen it at this point, as we should.
You know, when Sal's pizza shop gets burned down, I had a lot of conflicting thoughts about the actions that had taken place prior, because it had been a few years since I had seen the film, and I did not remember Sal being such a sympathetic character in that film, because Pino, he's a jerk.
Can I talk to you for a second?
What?
Pino, who's your favorite basketball player?
Magic Johnson.
Who's your favorite movie star?
Eddie Murphy.
Who's your favorite rock star? Prince. You're a Prince fan.
Boss, Bruce.
Prince.
Bruce.
Pino, all you ever talk about is nigga this and nigga that. And all your favorite people are so-called niggas.
It's different. Magic, Eddie, Prince are not niggas. I mean, they're not black. I mean, let me explain myself. They're not really black. I mean, they're black, but they're not really black. They're more than black. It's different.
It's different?
Yeah, to me, it's different.
I think his brother, is it Vito, is kind of friends with, I guess you can consider him friends with Mookie. And so they definitely have, you can't really say that, you know, you're on their side, but you understand where they're coming from. And when, as I was watching the film, I really appreciated, and I'd like to use a Driving Miss Daisy comparison, compare and contrast the films, because I really appreciated the fact that he didn't turn every single Black character in that film into someone who you would easily sympathize with, because that's not who human beings are. You know, I understand, you know, bugging out's cause. It's righteous. And he absolutely has every right to suggest that, hey, why don't you maybe show us a bit of appreciation instead of just taking our money and heading back over to, you know what I mean, you know, the other side of town. But, you know, at the same time, I thought it was interesting how Lee never comes out and says that, you know, we got to kick these people out and start our own thing. But there are a lot of characters in the film who are quick to point out the fact that, hey, you know, these people are here, but, you know, what have we done, you know, with any opportunities that we had in, you know, in order to, you know, start a convenience store. But, you know, at the same time, I also know that capital tends to, you know, gravitate towards more developed, more prosperous areas. And the holders of that capital, and this ties in the 13th, are going to view certain people, certain communities as undesirable. And as a result, you know, they're not going to have, you know, people like Buggin' Out and Radio Raheem and Mookie and all the others aren't going to have the same opportunities as others. And so I say all that to say that, you know, their actions are all justified, but I was very happy to see that Lee forces you to think about all of their actions, because I understand where it's coming from and it doesn't make it right, but he did the hard work of forcing you to justify your stances in relation to the other characters in the film.
It's so interesting, isn't it? Because there's I don't know if you've seen the t-shirt or the slogan going around, you know, about strong female character. What Hollywood needs scriptwriters to do is not just write, not just put more female characters in a film, but make them strong female characters. And that's such a sort of simplistic catchphrase that doesn't quite encapsulate what it is we actually want to need, which is complicated female characters, 360 degree female characters. And I think when I hear what you're saying, I'm hearing that Spike has set out to build a career on characters who are full human.
Yes.
There's no binary, you know, in a Spike Lee joint. He is prepared to look at everybody, warts and all.
I think that frustrates Hollywood. I think it frustrates white America, because they view racism as these acts that are acts such as burning a cross on someone's lawn or segregated busing and all of these other direct and full frontal assaults on individuals' peace and prosperity. But Lee doesn't, you know, he doesn't see it that way. As a Black man, he knows that it's a lot more nuanced, and you see that throughout the film. And I think that's one of the things that really will always frustrate me about, you know, the Academy and their refusal to even honor the film at that point in time, because I don't think it received a Best Picture nomination. And the Best Picture at the time, I ended up going to Driving Miss Daisy.
Every time someone says it out loud, it's still laughable.
It boggles
right?
my mind. Yeah, and to your point, it's a binary story, and the person who goes through this transformation, Jessica Tandy's character in the film Driving Miss Daisy, Daisy Worthen, and then Hoke Colburn, played by Morgan Freeman. But they're, like, to your point, yeah, they're very, you know, they're binary in the sense that they're both good people, but Jessica Tandy is a little, quote unquote, bad, because, you know, she has these ideas that are even in I guess that's in films take place in the 50s or 60s, but they're a bit antiquated and she needs to catch up a bit, but she doesn't have that far to go, if that makes sense.
Nah.
And she actually eventually gets there and racism is solved. We can move on with our lives now. And at the end of Do the Right Thing, you know that the problem is still there. And that it's going to take a lot of hard work, not just to rebuild, you know, Sal's pizzeria, but to mend that divide that in certain cases, particularly for Pino's character, will never be healed because he was the most aggressive in his viewpoints and in terms of really loving Black culture, which is a topic that has come up, you know, in recent past week or so, but because he loved Black culture, and there's a whole conversation between he and Mookie about it, but he hated Black people. It's complicated, but it's life as we know it.
And this is 31 years ago, and the only things that have changed are we've all got social media now. There are more people in prison, and there is a president in the White House who actively goads and encourages white supremacist ideology. I think that's fair to say.
Oh, yeah,
100%.
That's absolutely fair to say. And to go back to your earlier point, it boggles my mind that there are people that took issue with the ending of Black Klansman when, you know, this wasn't something that Lee, you know, cooked up on his own. You know, this is the reality that many of us are having to deal with. And it just shows, like I said, how far we have to go. And the fact that for some of us in the United States and in other parts of the world, racism is something that we deal with on a daily basis. But for others, it only rears its ugly head during these worst case scenarios. And then you have one community who has, you know, I mean, just to use a pretty simple example, who has learned their ABCs and, you know, can recite them forwards and backwards. And then you have another group in this country who's starting at A and now expects the other group to help them catch up and become more educated on something that is not our responsibility.
No, and that it is easy to get educated on, and especially with a couple of recent films, which I think do something, you know, important, but also quite magical. And I'm talking about I Am Not Your Negro and 13th. Yes. Both of which, interestingly, in the context of film and loving film and using film as a way to catch up on those ABCs, mm-hmm. both of which use footage from a century of American filmmaking to show how the Black experience has been captured and portrayed, both in news footage, but also in narrative storytelling. Sure. And you know, I know that many of us have attempted for as long as we possibly can to avoid ever seeing The Birth of a Nation, mm-hmm. the film. And then Ava just slams it right into 13, yes. you know, puts it there for all to see and has her incredible cast of extremely erudite commentators mm-hmm. just tell us what filmmaking like that did, which is essentially reignite the Ku Klux Klan. Mm-hmm. What I love about those filmmakers is that they use film, the good films and the extremely dodgy films, to continue to build up a bigger and more complex picture of Black life and of the Black experience in particularly American society. And the viewing numbers of those films as well. So it's not just narrative films that Letterboxd members are going for at this time. They are diving into the documentary experience. And I guess I wanted to get a sense of what your thoughts are about that and what your thoughts are about those films.
Documentaries are always powerful because, you know, I'm definitely a fan of the visual image, but I'm really a fan of directors and other storytellers who can take that image and then draw parallels between the past and present. And the 13th does that so well because there's a clip in that film that has now become, I don't want to consider a meme because a meme seems like too light of a word to use, but there's a scene where Donald Trump is talking. You hear his voiceover in the film, but then there are films where he's talking about roughing up, you know, protesters and others and just saying, you know, don't you, you know, just he's telling the police, you know, hit them harder and different things like that. And you see this image of this gentleman, black gentleman, who is, you know, dressed, you know, suit and tie. And we don't know what he's protesting, but you see an angry white mob pushing him back. And you know that they're punching him. They begin to punch him. They continue to push him. And as I watch that image, as I'm viewing the film, and I see that image, I can't help but think of whether or not you know, someone like a Donald Trump was informed, you know, by those types of images, and not the film itself, you know, not a film like 13th or I am Not Your Negro, but because there are people that'll see that image and they'll say, oh no, that was terrible. I'm so happy we're not like that anymore, which is not true. You'll have other people who say, ah, that's terrible, and we need to do something about it. But then you're also going to have people who say, oh wow, we need more of that.
I love the old days. You know what they used to do to guys like that when they were in a place like this? They'd be carried out on a stretcher, folks. Not true.
Knocking the hell out of that big man. The next time we see him, we might have to kill him.
In the good old days, they'd rip him out of that seat so fast.
And that's kind of where we're at in this country. And it's just very, very sad to see. There's no point in time here within, you know, the 21st century where, you know, white people are going to, you know, go off to their spaces. Black people are going to go off to their spaces, and, you know, we're going to be able to kind of exist separately. Where, you know, we have to figure this out. And I hope that film and, you know, this list and, you know, the films that are in it can be one of those pathways for, you know, someone who finds it on Letterboxd and, you know, decides to watch I Am Not Your Negro or Do the Right Thing. And, you know, maybe they're jolted and they start to think about these things in a different way.
You are listening to The Letterboxd Show. We are with Letterboxd patron Adam Davey, whose list Black Life on Film is the most comprehensive list of films portraying the Black experience available on Letterboxd. It's a piece of wonder that's taken 3 years of Adam's life to put together and is an ever-evolving piece of work. Adam, we've talked about a few of the big hitter films, but I wanted to ask, in these lists, what to you are some of the more miraculous films, not the ones that are getting all the attention at the moment that are sitting at the top of the most popular list on Letterboxd, but the miraculous smaller stories that you would like to steer our attention towards?
Can I start by providing you with a really popular film and then go from there?
Sure.
Okay.
your rules, man. Your rules. Okay.
All right. So I do want to mention Get Out, because you have to think about this from the perspective of Jordan Peele, you know, pitching this to the various studios and going to Blumhouse and, you know, telling them a story about a black man who's dating a white woman. And then he goes to their family's home to meet them for the first time. And then from there, strange things happen. And yeah. To be in that meeting, to hear that story and to think, well, what's so special about that? Because I'd be interested in hearing how much information Jordan Peele actually gave to, you know, to a Jason Blum and the other financiers who were involved in the making of this project. Because on paper, it feels like it wouldn't make as much sense until you actually see it. And sometimes, you know, you just have to go out on a limb. And, you know, Blumhouse did. The film costs, I think that was around the time where they were trying to stick to that $5 million budget mark. And they gave him the budget. He went out and shot it. And what we have now is just a bit of a masterpiece. I think that film in and of itself is a miracle. I think that I'm not sure where this next film is within your the top films of the week or the month, but I think the LA 92 is another film that is a bit of a miracle. The directors, TJ Martin and Daniel Lindsay, they crafted a film that is all archival footage. And it deals with the LA riots that took place in obviously 1992, which is in the title. But I read an article where it said that they went through probably thousands of hours of archival footage to put together pretty much a 2-hour story. And in doing so, it's probably one of the most affecting films on race relations, because to put it bluntly, it's white people's worst nightmare when it comes to Black uprising. Because I heard a woman say recently that you should be thankful, as a Black activist, but she said that you should be thankful that she's referring to Black people, that we just want equality and not revenge. But in that film, in LA 92, you see people who want revenge, and it gets ugly. And I love the fact that there are no, you know, voiceovers or no interviews of folks who were there to see it happen, because, you know, people try to spin things at that, you know, after the fact, but they just allow it to play out, and the film is all the better for it.
It reminds me of something I saw someone say this week, which is the most important Black filmmakers right now are the ones in the streets with their cell phones.
Yes.
And that is why we know what happened to George Floyd.
Yes. The visual image, even though there have been other cases, and that's the thing that frustrates me about some of what's taking place, because there have been other images of Black people being murdered by police and by individual citizens. But there was something about, you know, these, you know, the Ahmaud Arbery case incident and the murder of George Floyd that really struck a nerve with some people. And I'm sure that there are others who are smarter than me who could describe it a little bit better. But there was something about it. And it was the fact that there was a visual image to accompany, you know, this death that probably pushed people over. Because one of the things, I was talking to a friend recently, and I was saying that when you read about the murder of Breonna Taylor, the woman who was shot, I believe it was 8 times in her own home while she was sleeping, if you just read about the incident, it's in my mind 10 times worse than what we saw with George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery, because you know, for a variety of reasons, but she's not getting the same coverage. And that's also been another issue, you know, and it's another conversation for another day, another platform, about many of the Black women who aren't receiving the same amount of coverage.
And trans Black community.
And trans Black community as well. Yeah, absolutely. I'm going through the list. I see another film here. I'm going to point out, it's not a Black director, but Andrew Bajowski, Support the Girls.
Such a great film.
Yeah.
I'm sort of so glad that, you know, not to blow our own trumpet, but that film could have come and gone quite quickly. Mm-hmm. But platforms like Letterboxd allow small budget films like that to have a longer tail. Mm-hmm. You sort of start to see what your mutuals are watching and why they got something out of that. What did you love about it?
I think it ties back into my list in that it was a film about a Black woman, a Black person living a normal existence. It's a tired existence, because, you know, Lisa, played by Regina Hall, is put through the ringer on this one day at this local sports bar that she works at, with a variety of scenarios revolving around her own personal life and, you know, the lives of the women who she manages. But it was just nice to see something, because as much as I enjoy diving into discussions about race and watching films about race, it's also nice to just see people be normal human beings, because that's what I see in my everyday life as a Black man. When I think about my mother and, you know, my friends and other family, I just see people living a very normal life, and they're always interacting with race in one way or another. But for the most part, you know, they're able, you know, to go about their lives and be happy and be sad and, you know, go through the gamut of emotions that have been afforded to white characters over the years.
And that, you know, that for me was one of the most potent parts of I Am Not Your Negro, when James Baldwin is talking about being raised on a diet of films, a loving film, absolutely loving film as a boy and a young man growing up. And then the turning point when he realized that he wasn't John Ford, he was the Native American Indians. Yeah. But the realization that there's a lifetime of films about normal everyday experiences that do not apply. As I said earlier, there's been a huge increase in the number of logged watches and reviews on Letterboxd of films about civil rights, resistance, and the Black experience. And when I say huge, Ava DuVernay's documentary 13th is, at the time of this recording, the most popular film on Letterboxd. That's ahead of perennial favourites like Uncut Gems and Parasite and new releases like Josephine Decker's Shirley. Both Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing and BlacKkKlansman and Raoul Peck's James Baldwin biopic I Am Not Your Negro are also in the top 10 most popular films right now. We asked Letterboxd members to tell us why they're watching or re-watching these films at this time.
Hey, this is F from Oliver. I've been using the site for about 2 years now. And to answer the question, I think it's really awesome that a lot of films about race and prejudice are trending on the site right now, because I think they better help us understand the current moment and contextualize it. But in particular, I wanted to take the time to appreciate Spike Lee's BlacKkKlansman. It has been criticized in the past for not entirely unfair reasons, but I really like it personally because it shows, you know, these racists as buffoons and idiots throughout most of the movie's runtime. And then at the end, with the footage of the Charlottesville riots where that ties into the modern world, it shows us how these buffoons and idiots are actually being taken seriously and gaining political power. And I think that's scary, shocking, and frankly heartbreaking. Thank you for the time.
I would like to pick Quentin Tarantino's third movie, Jackie Brown. Jackie Brown blends Black exploitation, crime drama, and his very auteur revenge story. Jackie Brown is a 40-something Black woman. She's been marginalized by society and at this very current moment as a money launderer, so in crime itself as well. Once you watch it, you need to explore the genre. It is very Quentin Tarantino, but also is kind of like an ode to Black exploitation, and it's amazing.
So you've done this amazing piece of work, and then you've gone and subcategorized these films into other genre sections. So can we jump sideways into the romantic Black life on film list? And I want to ask you, what is your personal most romantic film on this list? What's the film that gets you going?
Last year, I watched Beyond the Lights, a film about a pop star who's kind of going through this. I guess she's probably in her young 20s, so probably like a quarter century crisis. And, you know, this young man played by Nate Parker, who's a police officer, comes into her life and they begin a romantic relationship. And there are a lot of great things about this film. Like I said, their characters are complicated. You know, we've seen the Black pop star before, but there are other films like, you know, like The Bodyguard. Dream Girl.
Alice Ross now, the High Note.
By
Natasha Bartley, it's just a great straight ahead 3.5 rated film, but I loved it. It's just especially at this time, if you're looking for a comfort blanket film, The High Note's great. Could sort of lean away from the music industry stuff and lean more into the personal development of each of the three characters. Maybe center the white character a little less, but you know, these are minor complaints about something that's, you know, fluffy and fun. That's my review of The High Note. back to Beyond the Lights,
it's
pure romance, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
It doesn't allow it to get swayed by any other genre, really. It's just pure romance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. And like I said, I just enjoy films where characters are allowed the space to be flawed and be something other than what we've come to expect, in the case of, you know, these pop star narratives, on point 24/7 or at the mercy of a white savior. And that doesn't happen in this film. You know, she is, I don't want to say she's completely saved by Nate Parker's character, Kaz, Nicole, but he does play a big part in her transformation. But it's also there's an equality there. They're on equal footing. That's what I loved about it. And it's probably one of those films that makes me I get really upset when I watch it, because I really like Nate Parker as an actor, but he made some decisions early on in his life and that have really affected his career. And I don't think there's any, at any point in time, he's going to be able to bounce back. But that's the only thing that kind of gets me down about the film, because he's really good in the film.
He's really good in it. And interesting, complicated at this time, his character is a cop. And that is part of the plot, is the complication of being this young black cop with a sort of bright, potentially political future. Yes. And yeah, it's definitely worth a rewatch if you're okay with that actor being in one of the lead roles.
Yeah, and that's tough for some people. Yeah, and it's always tough. I'm not sure how you feel about making certain recommendations when you see certain character or certain actors or actresses, depending on things that they said or actions that they've taken in the past, because some people can be triggered by that. And so I try to keep that in mind when I'm offering up recommendations.
What can we say? I think there's a lot of sadness, and I certainly feel it when I was first becoming a lover of film and a learner of the technique of mm-hmm. writing and directing. Woody Allen was up there for me. I am certainly one who struggles to separate the art from the artist. I know many people don't struggle with that and are able to see them as separate things, but I think that the intersectionist approach is that we need to acknowledge how people get to where they get.
Yes.
The support, whether implicit or explicit, that they've had to get there, and whether that support is to ignore past transgressions, that's part of it. Yeah, it's so complicated.
It is. It really is. I was going to say that, Nate Parker is gone, but now my new favorite, my favorite black actor at the moment is Kelvin Harrison Jr. And I'm not a huge superhero fan, but at the same time, I want him to take on one of those roles just so he can get some more attention and move from that rising star to superstar status. And the same, because I know that people love Michael B. Jordan, but Kelvin Harrison Jr. is Michael B. Jordan with acting skills. I know that's going to be controversial. That's going to be a very, very controversial opinion, but it's my opinion. That's it. I'm sticking to it. Fight me if you want to. My Twitter handle's in my profile.
The angry mob is at your door.
Angry mob is at my door. Hit me up in the DMs. I'll talk.
I have good news for you. Kelvin Harrison Jr. is in The High Note.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I did see that. So yeah, it's probably one of the reasons why I want to watch it.
Yeah, and he is. It's romantic. He mm-hmm. does that stuff well. You gotta get in there. And I also will say about The High Note, and it's a little bit spoilery. I will try not to spoil it. That there is a nice, gentle play on the theme of the white savior, and that Dakota Johnson's character is quite explicitly attempting to white save both her employer and her new lover. And whether it works or not is the measure of how modern this film is, and how the makers of the film understand the language of the oppressed and the language of the white savior. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't want to spoil it, but yeah. Nice try, Dakota, is all I'm going to say.
I have to point this film out as well, just to break things up so that we're not just dealing with heterosexual relationships. But there's a film by a gentleman, John Tringrove. The film is called The Wound. It's from 2017, and it's about this factory worker who's in a relationship with another man who's a part of his tribe. And if you think things are complicated in America, I believe that they're, homosexuality and the acceptance of gay couples in Africa are, it's much more complicated, I should say. And in this film, they're in a relationship together. It's basically revolves around them trying to prevent others from learning about this relationship.
Yabana lendona nokudibana nayo isendlini ihuqe ichomezayo. Fumane bezivalele ezikamereni. Kodwa izintwana man aziqonda kali kakuhle. Izintwana zezinana zelagaut.
because of the consequences or the repercussions that they could face as a result of it. And I find it fascinating. I think that if you wanted to make a double bill with this film, and I believe it's Rafiki, which I haven't seen yet.
I was going to say, we've got to throw Wanuri Kahyu's Rafiki in there because
It would be awesome.
Yeah. I mean, this Wanuri Kahyu's film is a miracle. If we're talking about films that are miracles and that they got to the screen at all, this is a miracle. It's called Rafiki. It's about Kina and Ziki, who are developing their romance in a society that doesn't accept queer relationships. And the fact of the film's existence is a miracle. The classification board said, you need to go back and change the ending because at the moment the ending is too happy, which gives our culture optimism about the chances for queer relationships.
Wow.
I mean, how wild is that? Go back and make the ending of your film sad. Otherwise, people will think that they can be gay here. Mm. And yet, on the other hand, so proud were Kenya of this film's existence that they allowed it to screen in cinemas for 1 week in order for it to be able to qualify for Oscar nomination status.
Okay.
But other than that, it wasn't allowed to be screened. So there's a really powerful story behind the existence of Rafiki, for starters. And it is available on that capitalist behemoth, Amazon. If you want to go and watch it. Oh, man, it's so complicated.
Yeah, absolutely.
That would be an amazing double bill, Wound and Rafiki. Yeah, and Rafiki. Also both set outside of the US. Can we talk action movies?
Yes.
Because I think, action movies are where we've had some of the best. We're talking about cops again. Should we talk about action movies? I'm going to say we've had some of the best cop partnerships that involve one or both of the leads being black. And, that's sort of interesting that there's a genre where black actors have been able to be elevated to stardom because America loves an action film. But on your list, actually, there are some other movies other than Bad Boys and Die Hard and Beverly Hills Cop that I haven't seen. So I want to know if you were going to recommend one or two action movies that portray the black experience in a great way, as well as being an amazing action film, what would they be?
I'm not sure how widely seen this film is, but I have to start with Attack the Block. Like, if you may not recognize a lot of film, a lot of actors in this film, but you will, if you are a Star Wars fan, you will recognize Finn, who's John Boyega. He is in this film. This was probably his first starring role. And there are certain actors, I just mentioned Kelvin Harrison Jr., where they just have it. Like, John Boyega has it. And if you didn't know about him from his film career, you probably know about him because of some of the recent activism that he's taking part in certain parts of London as part of the Black Lives Matter protests and other various protests against systematic injustice. But it's an awesome film because not only does it's centered around black characters living in the hood, but it's not about them living in the hood. It's about an alien that shows up to their doorstep.
No, I reckon, I reckon the Fed sent them anyway. Government probably bred those creatures to kill black boys. First they sent drugs to the ends. Then they sent guns. Now they sent monsters to get us. They don't care, man. We ain't killing each other fast enough. So they decided to speed up the process.
And, just like any other young teenager, they're inquisitive. They want to know what's going on. But shortly thereafter, some more aliens start to arrive and they're fighting for their lives. And I think that's fascinating.
Oh, so good. And it's got Jodie Whittaker, Doctor Who, is in it as well. Yes. And Nick Frost, who's been in pretty much all of Edgar Wright's films. And there's a lot to love about Joe Cornish's Attack the Block, but especially at this time, John Boyega, who is showing us what it looks like to really push the boat out when you are at the height of your career.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's one thing that I remember him saying during the protests, he got up to speak and he said, I may I may, something along the lines, I may ruin my career with this, but F it, I don't care. It's too important. And I think that for me, that just makes me love him more, because he understands, in a way, understands how serious these issues are in a way that many other entertainers, especially Black entertainers, don't. Because there are a lot of folks, especially Black actors, Black entertainers, who aren't willing to stick their neck out. And for good reason, because a lot of times their careers are built on the backs of white dollars. And if you think about someone like John Boyega and the franchise that he's a part of now, I mean, if his, I would say 95, 99% of his fan base are white males. And mm-hmm. some of the things that he was saying at that protest were probably things that they didn't want to hear, but they're necessary. And I hope that people and, you know, mainly studios, producers will continue to stick up for him, and his career will continue to flourish as a result. I don't know why this film continues to stick with me, because some people love it, some people hate it, but I really, really love I Am Legend. But I wish I had some time to really think about why. But I guess it's just like a Black guy on his own, and he has to save the world, you know, from this zombie invasion, you know, this group of night crawlers, or, you know, whatever. I can't think of what they refer to them as in the film. But it's just one of those things that really just appeals to me. And I think that's the thing about film and about the list that I created, is that I wanted it to be as imaginative and as fantastical as it was factual. Because people need to see that wide variety of images, to not to say that, you know, you can do anything that you want to do, because, you know, I mean, the scenario in this film, you know, knock on wood, isn't going to, you know, happen in our lifetimes. But it's nice to, at least in the world of film, to say that, you know what, it is possible for this to take place. And it is possible for an audience to see it, to believe it, and to go along for the ride, even if the person on screen doesn't look like you.
Love it. Adam, I'm going to wrap this up by asking you for, from within your Black Life on Film lists, your ultimate comfort film and your ultimate so bad it's good film. They may even be the same film. Who knows?
That's a good question. I'm going to say If Beale Street Can Talk is comforting for me, because what Barry Jenkins has been able to do over the last few years, in terms of providing just some great stories of Black love, both between, you know, a man and a woman, and, you know, two men with Moonlight, is just fascinating to me. And I'm not comforted by the story itself, because, as you know, it's based on a novel by James Baldwin, and Baldwin was someone who tackled race head on. He didn't pull any punches. And I remember Barry Jenkins saying that they actually changed the ending of the film to be a little bit more uplifting than what you actually read in the book. But I'm comforted by the fact that there are filmmakers today who are given space to tell these deeply romantic stories. Because, you know, if you just think about some of the scenes between the two main characters in that film, between Fonny and Tish, it's a deeply romantic film. And, you know, if I think that if there were two white characters, like I said, it would almost be taken into like that romantic drama area, because, you know, you wouldn't have the racism elements to it. So you just have this deeply beautiful love story between two people. But, you know, because, you know, the characters are Black, you know, race and the effects of it are part of their life. If I had to pick a film that's just so bad it's good, I think it's intentional. It's definitely intentional, but it's Black Dynamite.
You know, he came around here about a week ago with some cats that I had never seen before. Man, I mean, these cats look mean. Meaner than two fat motherfuckers wrestling over pork chops and greens. Can you dig it?
Yeah, I could dig it.
Oh yeah,
it has to be Black Dynamite, and because I've seen some blaxploitation films, I understand what some directors were trying to do, and I understand that at certain points in time that that was the only end for many Black actors in Hollywood, but the representations in many blaxploitation films aren't the most positive portrayals of Black men and women. And I love that, something like Black Dynamite takes this plot about, the character whose name is Black Dynamite, and he's fighting against the man. And I guess from what I remember, it's been about 6 or 7 years since I've seen the film. From what I remember, he ends up in the White House, like in a fist fight with Richard Nixon or something like that. It's just...
You had enough, Mr. President?
You'll never get away with this.
Watch me, you little insecure cracker. You think by shrinking our Johnsons is going to make your situation any better? That's your problem, Tricky Dicky. You are paranoid.
It's just one of those things that you would absolutely see in a blaxploitation film, because they weren't actually trying to depict the realities of the Black experience. It was really blown out of proportion. But Black Dynamite kind of takes it and has a little bit of fun with it. And it's... like I said, I think it was designed to be more funny than it was so good it's bad. But it hits the spot for me. But it's not the ultimate so bad it's good film for me. If I had to select that film, it's a film that's not on the list. It's a film called Miami Connection, which I'm not sure. Are you familiar with Miami Connection?
Miami Connection. Okay. Tell us about it.
Okay, Miami Connection. You know what? I'm not even going to try to put together my own synopsis. The Letterboxd description says, in a world where ninjas dream of being rock stars and rock stars dream of being ninjas, a martial arts rock band goes up against a band of motorcycle ninjas who have tightened their grip on Florida's narcotics trade. And in any other, scenario, if you put this scenario into the films of maybe like a Michael Mann or something like that, maybe you'd actually get something that's serviceable. But man, this film is so bad.
This looks like your brother. I didn't know you have a brother.
It's my father.
What? This is your real father?
Yes, it is.
Are you sure? I didn't know you had a father. I thought we are all orphans.
So bad is great. The gentleman, YK Kim, who directed and starred in the film, I remember him saying that he refinanced his house to make this film. And I guess that he went all in. He thought this was going to be an awesome ride, but it ended up just flopping to no degree. But then over time, it kind of gained cult status. And then I believe it was the Alamo Drafthouse who began screening it many years later. And then it kind of gained this cult status. And now it's one of those films it's not very good technically. But if you look at the Letterboxd rating, it's a 3.2. And yeah, for me personally, I'll watch pretty much any film that's above a 3.0.
You don't understand. I'm her brother. When I tell you to leave her alone, leave her alone.
Whatever you say.
Just remember what I said if you don't want to get hurt.
You don't scare me at all.
Jane, I want to talk to you later.
Goodbye.
So that tells you a lot about people's affections for this film. Because I love it to death, but I love it for all the wrong reasons.
I am just looking at Holly Horror's review on Letterboxd of Miami Connection, a 4-star review. She writes, there were a few issues I had with the story. Lol, I'm kidding. But besides the kick-ass fight scenes, the one attribute to the film which needs to be brought to light is the amazing songwriting. So I haven't seen it yet, but I'm sure that you'll know what that means.
You need to watch the film, and that song will make so much more sense, because they basically tell you the plot.
Trouble in the night.
Through many of the songs, and it's one of the most hilarious things about the film. And I don't want to spoil anything for you, so please watch it. And hopefully in a future episode, if you do a So Bad It's Good Films podcast. Hopefully you get to talk about that film along with a few others.
And it's so weird you should say that, because we're about to wrap up this episode. Our next episode is going to be a Studio Ghibli special, given that many of the films from the renowned Studio Ghibli are coming out on have come out on streaming services this year, and it's amazing how many more people are discovering the joys of a nap on a Totoro's belly. But the one after that, based on Letterboxd activity during lockdown, is going to be an episode around films so bad they're good. Because I don't know about you, but we are seeing a trend in watch-along parties between friends getting together to just watch the schlocky, inept, but absolutely bombastic and beloved movies that that should have been relegated to obscurity, but unfortunately platforms like Letterboxd came along, and the Alamo Drafthouse and, you know, other independent art house cinemas, and made sure that we will never forget the joys of the So Bad It's Good film. So yes, we will be going there, Adam. I'm so glad you mentioned it, and I am going to watch Miami Connection just for that episode.
Oh, you're going
to
love it.
Adam Davey, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show this week. We're so grateful for your time.
And thank you for having me.
This podcast is recorded in Pennsylvania and Auckland and edited by Morgan Avery. The music is Hitchcock by the Phoenix Foundation, and our podcast artwork is by Anne Davenport. You'll find links for all the films and lists we mentioned in the podcast description, and you'll find links for ways that you can support the Black Lives Matter movement and justice for George Floyd and Breonna Taylor in our list description. Please be assured that white supremacist ideologies have no place on Letterboxd, but love for films so bad they're good has every place on Letterboxd. You can find previous episodes of our podcast at letterboxd.show. Our next episode, as I just said, is all about the films of Studio Ghibli. And if any of the rest of you want to tell us your favourite Ghibli film and we'll feature your message on our show, you can hit the link and leave a message. Adam, your favourite Ghibli film?
It has to be the one that I remember most vividly, and that's Spirited Away.
It's a perfect. Thanks so much for listening. Black Lives Matter.
What are you doing, bud?
I can't move!
Okay, relax your fingers. We don't have time. Just let go. Be in the moment.
I am in the moment. It's a terrible moment.
They're right there. They're gonna see you. Miles, you gotta unstick. What do you do to relax?
Relax.
Needless to say, I'm back.
Oh, for crying out loud.
Calling it quits now, baby, I'm a wreck. You're a wreck.
Teenagers, just the worst.